Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Science Webinar Extra Q&A podcast. I have the pleasure of inviting back the two speakers from our April 30th, 2014 webinar entitled Targeting Telomeres in Human Disease, Advances and Therapeutic Opportunities, to answer some of your questions that we didn't have time to get to during the live broadcast. So welcome back to Dr. Roger Riddell from Children's Medical Research Institute in Sydney, Australia, and Dr. Sunit Agarwal from Boston Children's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Okay, I'm going to jump right into my first question, and that's going to go to Dr. Agarwal. What are the best methods for identifying telomere length?
I think the best method for identifying telomere length, as we discussed, for patients suspected to have short telomere syndromes, is the telomere FlowFISH on blood cell subsets. That technique has the advantages of having been developed to give mean telomere length in particular blood lineages, and it also has the advantage of having been validated in patients with telomere disease. I think the downsides of it are that you need fresh blood, so you need to be within a day or two of a testing center. And also one limitation we found is that we are sampling the affected tissue in patients with blood diseases. And so patients who have a failing bone marrow for other reasons might also have short telomeres in the blood. And I think one of the things we need is a validated test for other tissues. On a research basis, there are a few methods. So quantitative FISH on metaphase chromosomes is a great way to get a look at the lengths of individual telomeres on specific chromosomes and also then a population distribution. But it is labor intensive. Telomere length by Southern blot, as we showed, was also useful for a population distribution, but is a little bit limited in quantitation and also from the resolution of the agarose gel, depending on percentage and the distribution of telomere lengths. And then finally, telomere qPCR has been very useful as a high-throughput method for testing many, many samples and doing correlations in larger-scale studies.
Now, Dr. Agarwal, I'm going to give the next question to you as well. Does telomere length vary across different cell types and organs as we age?
I think the simple answer is probably yes. And you'd expect that, based on what we know, that telomere length would decline in proliferating cells as we age. And that's been demonstrated in blood cells and skin cells and other cells. Logically, there'll be a difference in telomere length between cells that do express telomerase, such as tissue-specific stem and progenitor cells, and compared to the telomerase-negative somatic cells that are derived from them. I guess one interesting question is how telomere length changes in what are considered post-mitotic cells that are thought to be quiescent, such as neurons and cardiac muscle cells. There have been some studies on this. There were discrepancies about how telomere length might change in muscle as a function of age, some studies saying that they do not shorten. But there was at least one study that showed similar rates of telomere attrition at various ages in leukocytes and in muscle. So telomeres are thought to shorten also in what are considered post-mitotic cells. Even in those studies, though, the telomere length seemed to be longer in muscle than in leukocytes. So the simple answer is yes, but it's not exactly quantified in different tissues yet.
And Dr. Riddell, maybe I can come to you for some thoughts on that as well.
Yes, look, there was a very nice paper on this subject published by Abraham Aviv's group fairly recently, maybe 2013. And I recall that they compared telomere length in leukocytes with a few other tissues. As Dr. Agarwal said, the telomeres were shortest in the leukocytes and longest in the skeletal muscle, and there were a couple of other tissues in between. But one of the notable findings was that the shortening rate was similar in all of the tissues. So it's very tempting to speculate on that basis that the differences in telomere length in the different tissues are set up early in life. But then the stem cells in the different tissues actually seem to be replicating at about the same rate during adult life, at least.
Excellent. And Dr. Agarwal, another question for you. Has telomere length been correlated with an increased risk of neurodegenerative diseases or other age-related syndromes?
So with respect to the neurodegenerative diseases, there have definitely been studies trying to correlate a risk of diseases like Alzheimer's disease, other forms of dementia, Parkinson's disease with peripheral blood telomere length. I think one thing to say is that it's probably hard to do the right study because here I've said the correlation was with peripheral blood telomere length, and you might want to know what the telomere length is in the specific cell type related to the disorder. But for practical reasons, of course, peripheral blood telomere length was measured. And there are papers on correlating short telomeres and the risk of Alzheimer's and other dementia, but the results are inconsistent. One set of studies that's interesting is in large studies on Parkinson's disease, the results actually seem to suggest that men with shorter telomere length had a reduced risk of Parkinson's disease, and there's really no explanation for that finding, but it's been seen a couple of times. So I think the jury is out. In terms of other age-related syndromes, certainly it's been shown that low telomere length is a risk factor for pulmonary fibrosis, independent of mutations in telomerase genes. There's also been a lot of interest in telomere length as a predictor of cardiovascular disease, but again, like the dementia cases, there's no definitive association yet.
So, Dr. Riddell, let me come to you with a few questions. What percentage of cells engage in recombination in an ALT-dependent tumor?
That's a very interesting question. We don't actually have the technology to look at this on an individual cell basis yet. So I actually can't give it a definitive answer. But my expectation would be that most cancer cells in an ALT-dependent tumor, that's the cancer cells as opposed to the stromal cells, would need ALT activity from time to time, otherwise they'd be lost from the replicating population because their telomeres would shorten and they'd undergo senescence or cell death. So the short answer is, the expectation is most cells, most or all of the cancer cells, but we don't know that for sure.
Great. And related to that, looking at wild-type cells, why wouldn't all cells rely on ALT?
Well, I think the answer might be that most cells do rely on ALT, at least to some extent. I don't think I'm alone in speculating that ALT is actually the archetypal telomere lengthening mechanism, if you will, which eukaryotes used for the 400 million years or so before telomerase appeared on the scene. We don't have an easy assay for detecting ALT activity, especially in the presence of telomerase. But my lab and others have found evidence that there is ALT activity in mouse somatic tissues that also have telomerase activity. The other clue, I suppose, is that ALT gets switched on in tumors from all types of human tissues. And so it may be relatively infrequent in many types of tumors, but the point is that it seems to be there and capable of being upregulated in cancer. So my hypothesis would be that ALT continues to contribute to normal telomere maintenance, even if it's not the dominant mechanism. And clearly it's not redundant with telomerase because hypomorphic mutations in telomerase components cause short telomeres and the syndromes that Dr. Agarwal has been talking about. But because telomerase is present at limiting amounts, maybe we will find one day that there are mutations that decrease ALT activity in normal cells and they also lead to disease.
So let me stay with you for one final question, a little bit more specific in coming back to cancer, is has the ALT mechanism been described in leukemias?
There are a few hints only that ALT might be present in leukemias. There was a study published last year, I think, that showed increased levels of extrachromosomal telomeric DNA, which is one of the telltale signs of ALT activity, in telomerase negative chronic phase CML cells, but I don't recall that any other markers of ALT activity were looked at. And if my memory is correct, the large survey of ALT in cancers that was published a few years ago by the Johns Hopkins group included a number of lymphomas, but there were no leukemias at all. So I think the answer to the question is that this hasn't been studied in detail yet, and it's an area that's really wide open.
Excellent. Dr. Agarwal, let me come back to you for a quick question. How much is known about variation in telomerase activity in normal cells?
So if by normal cells we mean normal human cells, so certainly there's a lot known that in most human somatic cells, there's no telomerase activity. But in the stem and progenitor cells that maintain the lineage, there is telomerase activity. That's different in other organisms where even the somatic tissues do express telomerase, such as mice. In humans, though, an exception to the rule about somatic cells is lymphocytes, which have telomerase activity and show dynamic changes in telomerase levels over various phases of their maturation, such as from naive to effector to memory stages. And, of course, the cancers of several lineages express telomerase. But I think that in terms of variation in quantity and quantitation of telomerase activity, I think there's still relatively little known about variation at the single cell level, partly due to difficulty in separating cell populations in some types of tissues, but more so due to the fact that real quantitation of telomerase activity is actually not that easy. So it's easy to get a yes or no answer, but fine quantitation is still a little bit difficult.
Now, here's a question for both of you, and let me start with Dr. Riddell. Recent reports suggest the existence of multiple telomere maintenance mechanisms in telomerase-positive cancer cells, as well as different ALT mechanisms. This adds additional constraints on targeting therapeutics, does it not?
Yes. So we've known for quite some time that telomerase and ALTs can both be present in a tumor. And in this case, it's very likely that treating with inhibitors of one or other of those mechanisms is, will be ineffective. So a combination approach is going to be needed there. Regarding the second part of the question, though, I'm not convinced yet that there's more than one ALT mechanism in human cells. Certainly, telomerase-negative yeast cells can survive via several different mechanisms. So there seem to be more than one mechanism you could call ALT in yeast. My lab, over a number of years, has shown that in human cells, the ALT copying mechanism can utilize different copy templates. But we've also shown that this happens in the same cells. And the simplest explanation, I think, is that this is actually the same mechanism. Although some of our publications may have given a rise to the impression that there's more than one ALT mechanism, I don't think we've got any clear evidence yet that there is more than one, in human cells at least. If this does turn out to be the case, and that would be very interesting, it may complicate things from a therapeutic point of view, but we'll face that when we get to it.
Dr. Agarwal, any thoughts from you?
So I don't have anything to add to what Dr. Riddell already said about the molecular mechanisms, but I'll just say something from a clinical perspective. The relative importance of multiple mechanisms along one pathway in maintaining a cancer cell really is only made clear by seeing what happens when you knock out one of the pathways from a therapeutic standpoint. So it may not be a cure, but it might still provide a significant benefit, especially in combination with other types of therapy.
Dr. Agarwal, another question for you. If you inhibit telomerase in cancer cells, what effect does it have on telomerase needed in normal cells?
So presumably, it will, unless you've found a way to target the telomerase in the cancer cell population, whatever molecule you use will also inhibit telomerase in normal cells. And then the therapeutic efficacy, like other drugs, will depend on tissue distribution of the drug, sensitivity of the cancer cells relative to normal cells in terms of telomerase inhibition, toxicity profile, probably individual differences in how the drug is metabolized. So I think that from a clinical standpoint, it's important to remember that every cancer drug has side effects, and most of the conventional ones are non-specifically targeting cells that replicate a lot or some fundamental cellular pathway, and then the therapeutic index is accounted for by the relative effect on the cancer cell versus regular cells and also other dose-limiting toxicities. So I imagine that the effect would still be the same on normal cells at a biochemical level, but you may still get some therapeutic benefit.
Coming back to you, Dr. Riddell, do you have any ideas as to the mechanisms of TERT promoter mutations in telomerase activation?
I guess this could be answered in a couple of ways. The first would be regarding the mechanism that actually causes the mutations. And what's been observed in this regard is that in malignant melanomas, where these mutations are common, Mutations are mostly C to T changes, which is the signature of UV damage, DNA damage by ultraviolet light. But there are many other tumor types where UV light is not a factor in causing TERT promoter mutations. And some of them might be due to apobec cytidine deaminase expression during the oncogenesis process. Presumably, however they occur, like other oncogenic mutations, they're occurring in a random way, and then they are selected for because of their pro-oncogenic effects. The second way of looking at the question, though, would be, what is the mechanism whereby the mutations upregulate telomerase levels? And I think the evidence is quite good that the mechanism is the creation of ETS transcription factor sites, which then most likely results in transcriptional upregulation of TERT expression. It's been documented in all sorts of ways that TERT is present in limiting quantities. So when it gets upregulated, this can increase telomerase activity, at least to a certain extent. But interestingly, the telomerase RNA subunit is also present in limiting amounts. And we don't know if this gets coordinately upregulated, and if so, how. So I think there's a lot to that question that we still really need to understand.
And a follow-on question for you, Dr. Agarwal, is have you found any TERT promoter mutations in the congenital diseases that you've looked at?
So not that I know of in the short telomere syndromes. Promoter mutations have been described for TERC, the RNA component, and also DKC1, which encodes Discarin. And I think it's highly likely that there will be, at some point, found promoter mutations or other inactivating regulatory element mutations for TERT. It wouldn't be that surprising to see that.
And do you think it'll be possible to target those promoter mutations?
So in terms of the TERT promoter mutations, perhaps targeting the ones that are causing cancer, just historically in general, it's been very hard to target regulatory element mutations or the transcription factors that are dysregulated by regulatory element mutations. So the way conceptually one might think of is targeting the product if there is upregulation that is thought to drive the cancer. As Dr. Riddell was saying, I think it still remains to be established if and how the TERT promoter mutations are drivers, presumably by upregulating the limiting amounts of TERT protein. And so then the question becomes, if by knocking it back down to the normal amount, does that actually provide a real benefit in the cancer overall, or have you just actually eliminated the clones that were evolving to have a marginal advantage over the non-TERT overexpressing clones of the cancer?
And I think we have one more time for one more question, so I'm going to give this to both of you. For telomere length studies, mice and other model organisms do not precisely mirror human telomere lengths. Are any models available that might be used or developed in the future to study telomere shortening in vivo? Maybe Dr. Riddell, you could answer that first.
So I'll just mention one. I think zebrafish are looking very good as a model system, with, you know, telomere lengths close to those of humans. They've got restricted telomerase expression in their tissues, and the telomere lengths are human-like. And telomerase knockout fish have already been made, and the first-generation animals die prematurely. They've got short telomeres and many features of premature aging, and their tissues accumulate senescent cells. So I think this is showing a lot of promise as a model system for studying whole organism effects of telomere shortening.
Dr. Agarwal, any final words from you on model systems?
Yeah, I agree. I was also going to say that I think zebrafish are looking quite good because of their telomere length. Mice have been, inbred laboratory mice have been difficult because some of them have extremely long telomeres on the order of 30 to 120 kilobases, and humans have telomere length probably less than 15 to 20 kilobases on average. There have been some wild-derived inbred strains of mice, such as Cas-E, that have a telomere length of 18 to 20 kilobases, and indeed in telomerase mutations of those mice, they do show phenotypes such as reduced fertility and organ dysfunction and reduced survival early generations. But there's a little bit more complexity in back-crossing mutations onto those mice. So that model in zebrafish is also looking quite good.
Well, that's unfortunately all we have time for right now. So many thanks to both of our speakers for joining me for this podcast. Dr. Roger Riddell from the Children's Medical Research Institute in Sydney, Australia, and Dr. Sunit Agarwal from Boston Children's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. Many thanks to our audience for listening in, and I hope you'll join us for future webinars available at webinar.sciencemag.org. Thanks very much, and goodbye.